Hey folks, David here. Just a brief note before we begin the podcast. Frank and I recorded this over Skype, and as Skype is wont to, some of Frank's audio is a little bit jumbled, but we think it's a pretty good episode anyway. We are in the process of switching over to new recording software for the future, so hopefully this will be a problem we can rectify in the future. Anyway, enjoy the episode. Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh, and I'm joined, as always, by Frank Cagliano. But, Frank, you are not in Edinburgh. Where are you?
I am not, David. I'm just outside of Stockholm, Sweden, where I am on vacation at the moment.
And how are things in Sweden?
They're great, although it's very hot by Swedish standards. So it's been, well, this afternoon it's a relatively cool 83, 28 if you're listening in Celsius. But it's been in the low 30s Celsius, kind of low 90s for much of the time I've been here. And this is not something that Swedes are accustomed to.
Oh, okay. So, Frank, I want to lay on two propositions to you, and you tell me what you think. Proposition number one, since the Trump election, lawyers have been in the headlines a lot. Starting with all the lawyers who fled out to the airports for the travel ban, to Michael Cohen, to Rudy Giuliani, Robert Mueller, James Comey, Michael Avenatti, Rod Rosenstein, Brett Kavanaugh. The list could go a lot longer.
Jeff Sessions,
to be sure. So lawyers are in the headlines a lot, even today. I saw Michael Avenatti's considering running for president, which is kind of crazy. And proposition number two is that lawyers have played a very prominent role in American politics from the very beginning. What's your take?
I would agree with both of those propositions, which of course are not mutually exclusive. Before we proceed, though, you've given that long list of lawyers in the news for the past 2 years. Who's your favorite? I'm not saying best or most admirable. I'm just saying of this cast of characters, which is really a kind of rogues gallery to some extent, who's your favorite lawyer from the Trump era?
So far, I'd be Robert Mueller. But I should say, by way of disclosure to our audience, I come from a family of lawyers. My parents are both lawyers. My father-in-law is a lawyer and a judge. So I've been in amongst lawyers my entire life. Some of whom I think are still disappointed I didn't go to law school. Yours? Who is your favorite lawyer of the bunch?
I mean, of course, Mueller is the one I'm investing the most hope in and is arguably the most heroic. But the story is... you know, if I can make a horrible pun, the jury's still out on that. hey, I'm on vacation. Give me a break. However, I guess I have two favorites. I have to confess, I like Michael Avenatti. If I ever get in trouble and need a lawyer, he's the one I'd want. He's sort of the racehorse Haynes of this story in terms of a defense lawyer who can defend anyone. And he is very, very compelling on television. And the other one who I can't look away from is Rudy Giuliani. I mean, when he's on, it's can't-miss TV because he's insane.
He is the worst lawyer ever, partially because he has the worst... I mean, client ever, because they constantly contradict one another about what exactly their position is.
Hold on. I'm not even sure he's the worst lawyer involved in this story, because we still have Michael Cohen as well.
Oh, that's true, but at least Michael Cohen mostly keeps his mouth shut and realizing that he has... Anyway.
I mean, Rudy is can't-miss TV, it must be said, just in a kind of train wreck kind of way.
Right, to be sure. But I mean, one thing that strikes me just thinking about this on sort of the broad spectrum of things is that, in some ways, it's very unusual how prominent lawyers are in American history. If you think about, you know, the more than half of the people who've been president were lawyers, either before they were president or after they were president or both.
You know, the lawyers play a very prominent role in, the revolution. Lawyers have played a prominent role in American politics, you know, ever since. And that, I think, is a little bit unusual, that lawyers as a class of people is where our political, leadership comes from, at least compared to most other Western democracies or other countries around the world.
I'm not sure I go that far, although I have to confess that I have, in thinking about this episode, I didn't do a lot of comparative research. I agree with your premise, which is that lawyers are particularly prominent in American politics, and I think and history, and I think we want to explore that. They're not uncommon in other places.
To be sure.
But whether, in terms of heads of state, what proportion of them are lawyers across, the other G7 countries would be an interesting kind of, historically, an interesting study to do. And I do suspect the United States is probably an outlier in that. I don't want to anticipate your next question, which I guess is why, and let's look at the historicals of this. In part, I guess that's because, going back to my own period, the American Revolution was very much a dispute about the law, and many of the leaders of the revolution, I'm thinking about, the obvious ones like Madison, Jefferson, and Adams, of course, were lawyers. It's the old saying, when all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. If you're a lawyer, you're going to approach things in a legalistic way. But the dispute that led to the American Revolution was very much about the rule of law, and was concerned with the law. And, of course, one of the most important legacies of the Revolution is the American Constitution, which is a legally binding document and to some extent acts as the kind of the touchstone for American politics. And so I think that helps explain the prominence of lawyers in American politics. Ever since the beginning, the law and politics have been very closely aligned in the United States.
Yeah, it's I think worth pointing out that the phrase that the United States is a nation of laws and not of men, comes from John Adams from, I think, 1780 or something, with the Massachusetts Constitution, that, they think very much in terms of the founding, the revolutionary leaders think very much in terms of, legal structures and legal, precedents in terms of how they thought about the American Republic and what it would be and the ways in which it would be different, at least in their minds, from other nations around the world at the time.
That's right. And I think the emphasis on the law is very much a legacy of the revolution. Mm. And really, the revolution, when those rebellious British colonists in North America go from being subjects of George III, subjects of a monarch, to citizens of a republic, that is a legal distinction. They're very much focused on defining the relationship of the individual to the state, and that relationship is mediated by the law and interpreted by courts. And so the law and the people who are responsible, if you will, practitioners of it, lawyers, have been kind of central to the story from the very beginning, I think.
Are there specific elements from the revolution that sort of jump out to you where the role of lawyers and the sort of legal framework was particularly relevant or pressing?
Of course you have one of the most famous instances or incidents right before the revolution is the Boston Massacre in 1770. But one reason the Boston Massacre becomes such an important moment is not just because British soldiers shoot at and kill civilians in the streets of Boston in the disputes over taxation. It's also the fact that those soldiers are tried in a civilian court in Boston. In fact, the soldiers are defended in court by John Adams, and most of them are acquitted. it's actually a pretty good result, actually. Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems to me. But that moment is important because one of the, and it's an important propaganda moment, it's an important political moment, but legally it was important because it was intended to demonstrate, I think, that the rule of law still applied, even though people in Massachusetts were resisting British rule. And so the Patriots, as they were called, were kind of walking a fine line between protesting British rule, but also maintaining that they were not lawless. Hmm. They, you know, that the rule of law mattered, and that British soldiers who killed American civilians, Bostonians, could get a fair trial in Boston in the aftermath of that, and they did. And Adams, who of course was a supporter of the resistance against Britain, famously defended those soldiers because he believed the rule of law was all important. So I think that's quite an important and telling moment. And then if we cast our minds forward, the aftermath of the revolution, you know, during Shays' Rebellion in 1786 in Western Massachusetts, what do the Shaysites do? They close down the courts to stop what they see as unjust cases being taken against them for prosecutions for debt. And that is going to prompt or be one of the things that will prompt the drafting of the federal constitution, which of course is a legal document, a legally binding document. And crucially, one of the things that comes out of that process is the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, which are foundational to American law and politics ever since. I think, David, the crucial point here, and this was underlying your original points you posited, is the close relationship between the law and politics. So the Boston Massacre trial was a legal process, but it was also political. It was making a political statement. The Bill of Rights, the adoption of the Bill of Rights, and what's included in those amendments, and what wasn't included, and how they've been interpreted ever since, is a matter of law, of course, but it's also a matter of politics, I think.
Hmm. Now, when we say that John Adams or Thomas Jefferson or Madison or whoever else, in the Revolutionary era was a lawyer, what does being a lawyer, how did one become a lawyer in the 18th century? What was the training? What did it mean to be a lawyer?
Yeah, I mean, in the 18th century, in the early 19th century, so going in really into your period, the way you didn't go to law school. In fact, you know, we work at a British university, and the kind of archaic way to refer to what our students major in, you don't hear it as much now as you used to, is people will say, oh, I read history at the University of Edinburgh. And that's an archaic usage that goes back to the 18th century, because in the 18th century, people used to read law. So Thomas Jefferson studied at the College of William and Mary in Williamsburg, Virginia, between 1760 and 1762. He never graduated, never formally got a degree from William and Mary, but he studied there. And then he read law under George Wythe, who was a prominent lawyer in Virginia. And what reading law meant, basically, you worked as an apprentice. You studied with a lawyer. You read Blackstone's commentaries in particular. You studied the common law, you studied law, and then you prepared for what was called, what we now call the bar exam, but it was formerly an oral exam for admission to the bar. So lawyers, local lawyers, would interview you and basically decide whether you knew enough law to practice law. So it was a much more vocational approach to education than law school is today. I know we're going to talk about the evolution of legal education in your period, but in this earlier period, it was much more vocational and ad hoc and one-to-one. So as I said, Jefferson read law with George Wythe. He always disdained the great Virginia lawyer Patrick Henry and his contemporary. Henry is, of course, famous for saying, give me liberty or give me death in the run-up to the revolution. Henry was very, very eloquent, extremely eloquent, and very persuasive.
Yeah.
He might be considered the Michael Avenatti of his day. But Jefferson always resented Henry because he basically thought, if you'll pardon my language, that he was a bullshitter. That Henry was very eloquent, but he didn't have any, he didn't know the law very well. Whereas Jefferson, of course, was an intense
student. He was a nerd.
Almost everything. He was a nerd, but he wasn't a very good public speaker. And so although he knew the law inside out, or at least as he saw it, Henry didn't know much law. He had a smattering of law, but he was very, very articulate and fluent and persuasive, and he was a showman. And that, you know, this is one of the flaws of a legal education in this period. So Henry was admitted to the bar as far as Jefferson was concerned, because he was able to kind of blether his way through, but he didn't have the strong foundation in it. And so this was legal education prior to the middle of the 19th century, really the late 19th century, is fairly patchy. I mean, I won't say anybody can become a lawyer, but you really need to just get the local legal establishment to agree that you know enough law, and you only have to know as much law as they do, which might be very slim, in order to be admitted to the bar.
I mean, and this, the same sort of pattern was true of Abraham Lincoln, who of course was also primarily a lawyer before he became president. You know, and he, you know, unlike Jefferson, never even went to college, never really had any formal education of any kind, and basically read law on his own. So he read Blackstone, he read Greenleaf's Evidence, he read Joseph Story's work on jurisprudence, which was, you know, there's this small shelf of texts that people read, and then if you persuade the local bar that you were sufficiently well-versed in these, they got admitted to the club.
Can I ask you two questions about Lincoln, David?
Sure. You can ask me as many questions. Whether I have answers is a different question.
Right. The first is, given how we framed our discussion today, is Lincoln, in your view, our greatest lawyer politician or politician lawyer?
Well, in as much as I think he's our greatest politician, I would tend to think so. You know, he was a well-known, he was within legal circles in Illinois, he was considered to be a good lawyer, one who's obviously a skilled rhetorician, one of the skills that trial lawyers in particular sort of cultivate, and that translates well into politics, is the ability to speak to a jury and speak eloquently on one's feet. You know, he wasn't by any means a rock star lawyer, though, in the 19th century. There were other lawyers of that time that were much better known than he was. And, you know, as a lawyer, he took on all kinds of cases. He was known for being a railroad lawyer, for instance. But he also defended people accused of petty crimes. He was in deal with property disputes, all these kinds of things. In terms of how his lawyering, though, you know, shaped his presidency, I think he was very much, you know, his conception of the power of the presidency and the role of the Constitution was very much shaped by his legal training. He often made very fine distinctions as president between, you know, what his political position was, what he thought was legally permissible, what he thought the constitutional position, the moral position. He made very, very fine distinctions between things, and I think that's very much rooted in his, you know, legal training.
Okay, now I've got a number of questions, so let me ask my original second question, which is, this is something that's always puzzled me about Lincoln. I've been very impressed. Is you have this incredibly skillful politician, but also very, very gifted writer and prose stylist. I mean, arguably, he's the greatest prose stylist who's ever occupied the presidency. But as you said, he's essentially an autodidact. How do you explain that?
I think probably beyond my pay grade to explain. I think he was simply the greatest example we have in American history. Well, maybe not the greatest, but at least in the top 10 of somebody who is, you know, truly a self-made man, somebody who came from a fairly modest background, somebody who really through reading as a child and as a young man taught himself, you know, politics, taught himself history, taught himself literature. You know, by all told, I think he spent, at least according to his own account, 2 months in school in his entire life, and didn't think he learned anything in those 2 months in school. You know, how one goes from that to being, you know, an extraordinarily gifted rhetorician, I think part of it may have simply been he had, as part of his legal practice, a great deal of training, not training in terms of you know, something being taught, but a great deal of experience speaking to juries, speaking to audiences, and I think the more you do that, the better you get at it. So I think he had tremendous force of will and a tremendous intellect, you know, an ability to connect with people both on the page and in person. So I think, I'm not sure that explains it, but I think that's as close as I'm going to get.
Okay, now, sorry, if I may follow up.
Oh, sure.
This is like a legal case. in terms of, I was interested in the distinction you made in answering my question about Lincoln between his skills as a politician and his skills as a lawyer and how they complemented each other. If he is the greatest politician the United States has seen who was a lawyer, who is the greatest lawyer politician? In other words, putting the emphasis on their achievements as a lawyer rather than as a politician.
Oh,
do you understand what I'm asking?
Yes. I guess there's a few people we could pick from. John Quincy Adams, I think, would be on the list. As somebody who argued before the Supreme Court, both before he was president and after he was president, I think he actually probably enjoyed being a lawyer more than he enjoyed actually being in the White House. In terms of more recent figures, you know, I think we've had a number of very keen lawyers rise to very high public office or close to high public office. I think both Bill and Hillary Clinton were extraordinarily gifted lawyers in terms of their legal thinking, although both of them ended up doing some stupid things legally that got them into all kinds of trouble. President Obama, of course, was a law professor before he was a politician. And so, you know, he had a very, I think, keen legal mind that I think both helped him and hampered him sometimes in the White House. Nixon was also an extraordinarily accomplished lawyer. So I think we can, you know, cast of skilled politician lawyers sometimes goes on both ends of the political spectrum. Who would you put in the?
I would agree. I mean, I think that was an excellent suggestion. And the two that I had in mind were Barack Obama and Richard Nixon. So I was thinking about that, and Nixon comes to mind because, of course, he will come into some legal difficulties himself.
yes, to be sure.
And one thing that occurred to me in your comments about Lincoln, again, a follow-up question would be, you know, is it important that the president be a lawyer? Because the Constitution really is the user's manual for the job. And somebody who studied the law, particularly constitutional law, would seem to me to be best placed to do that. Not to the extent that it should be exclusive, because we've had successful presidents who were not lawyers, and some unsuccessful presidents who were. And Nixon's an interesting case in point, because as you say, he was a skilled lawyer, but he got himself into real constitutional difficulty. On the other hand, one looks at the mounting legal problems for Donald Trump, and you think, well, a little bit of legal training wouldn't have hurt you, pal. or at least having read the Constitution before. Do you think it's a prerequisite for a successful presidency?
Well, I mean, I think the law cuts both ways. And one way people approach the law is the law gives you a set of precepts and rules and guidelines about how to conduct oneself. There's within the law, I think, a sort of implied sort of ethical code about how one is supposed to conduct oneself as a member of the bar. So you have, I think, one class of legal training that leads you to play by the rules and support institutions and norms and uphold precedents. The other sort of the sort of flip side of that, though, is the law teaches you in some ways that if it's not against the rules, you can go ahead and do it, and you should look for exceptions and loopholes and fine print where you can. So the question is, are you a Michael Cohen kind of lawyer? Are you a James Comey kind of lawyer? Which of those sort of overarching ways of thinking about the law, is the law a way of upholding Republican institutions, small r Republican, or is it a way of, doing a get out of jail free card? And I think, when we think about lawyer politicians, whether we, think about Nixon, whether we think about, Bill Clinton with his various, depends on the meaning, what the meaning of the word is, sometimes that legal training gets them into as much trouble politically as it does serve as an aid to them.
David, I know we want to go back. There's some material we need to cover in the 19th century, but one thing that struck me, you mentioned Hillary Clinton. The law, to a large extent, for much of American history, although probably not the last 50 years, and one could extend it perhaps a little bit further than that, has largely been a boys' club. What I was describing in the early 19th century, of course, or late 18th century, was a boys' club. But this notion that the sort of local lawyers would examine you and decide whether you were worthy or not, it's a fraternity ritual. It's admission to a fraternity as much as anything for a long time.
Yes.
And, we began with, and again, I don't have the information at hand here, so I'm wandering out into no man's land a little bit on this, or no person's land. But I wonder if the relative lack of women at the highest levels of American politics is a reflection of the dominance of the law as the kind of entree into the highest levels of American politics. I don't know. I really am talking off the top of my head here, but there is a kind of discrepancy. We've never had a woman president.
Sure.
We came close, but we have not had a woman president. Is the dominance of the law one of the obstacles there?
I think it's one of obviously many, many barriers to women being involved in politics, given how much the law is a conduit through which people enter into politics. We have women getting admitted to the bar for the first time really in the late 19th century, but even then it's on a very, very limited basis, and the law remains, an overwhelmingly a boys' club, to use your phrase, until the second half of the 20th century, and then even then, really into the 80s and 90s, law was overwhelmingly dominated by men. Thinking about though that moment when women first get admitted to the bar in the aftermath of the Civil War, there's a really interesting moment where the legal profession is changing. In the 1870s and 1880s, because law is becoming professionalized then in a way that it wasn't beforehand, that you go from the kind of informal training that Thomas Jefferson and Abraham Lincoln had to a situation where you're having the creation of law schools in the 1870s and 1880s, where you have a formal legal education. You're having the formation of state bar associations that create sort of frameworks for institutionalization of law. You have the foundation of the American Bar Association in 1878, which is the largest legal organization in the United States. And I think that's really a turning point in terms of the ways in which law becomes professionalized. And this happens, I think, at the same time that lots of other professions are also taking on this professional cant. So this is at the same time that doctors in the United States are becoming professionalized, and what it is to be a doctor versus not being a doctor becomes institutionalized. It's when the American Historical Association is founded, and so there's this Gilded Age sort of move towards professionalization that happens with the law in the late 19th century. And so I think if we think about the history of law and politics, I think that's an important moment. Because you have groups like the American Bar Association, they are helping to create sort of guidelines for legal behavior. They're creating guidelines for legal education. They end up eventually credentializing law schools. And eventually in the 20th century, the American Bar Association is vetting federal judges for most of the second half of the 20th century. When the president appointed someone to a federal judgeship, the American Bar Association would investigate their legal training and background and interview various people associated with them and give a kind of ranking about how qualified they thought they were. So I think that's a really...
But they would do so in a nonpartisan way, right?
Yes. Well, we'll get to that. But at least the idea was... And remains when the American Bar Association does this, that it's not about the positions the judge is taking, it's about their qualifications to hold the office that they're being named to. And I've actually been able to see some of this process firsthand because I know some lawyers who've been part of the process of vetting federal judges. And they go and they talk to people's former law partners. They talk to law school classmates. They talk to people who had clerked with judges in the past. They, read all of the opinions that people wrote in law school review articles, and basically just assess, the relative merits of the person as a qualified legal thinker. All of which I think is about a kind of professionalization of the law that happens really in the start of, or the middle of the 19th century, and has really only increased since then, where, practicing law is really requires 3 years of legal education beyond the undergraduate degree in the United States, and then continuing legal education afterwards, and a sort of professional vetting of what it is to be a lawyer. It's not a part-time job the way it could have been or often was in, say, the 19th century or the 18th century. It can't be an avocation. It really becomes a profession. And thinking about...
So you couldn't today read law, do all the casework.
No.
Get a syllabus from Harvard Law School, follow the syllabus, but not graduate, but not attend.
No.
Otherwise, and then take the bar exam and pass it.
No, you can't do that. They won't let you sit the bar exam. They wouldn't license you to be a lawyer. No, you couldn't do that. So there's a ways in which there are sort of gatekeepers for the law that sort of arose from this Gilded Age and Progressive Era conception of expertise and professionalism that has remained with us.
Is it necessary? In other words, the bar exam is meant to be a professional qualification.
Mm.
So provided you could pass the bar exam, why does it matter whether you spent, hundreds of thousands of dollars to attend Harvard or Yale or even less prestigious law schools that are also expensive. When the Abraham Lincoln out there, who's just really clever and reads a lot and studies the case law, why is it such a bad? Would it be such a bad thing if they could just turn up and pass the bar exam?
Yeah, I think it's the law is a lot more complicated now than it was in the 18th or the 19th century. And the amount of sort of specialization within the law is profound enough where, you know, I wouldn't want to hire a lawyer who hadn't really been professionally trained, much in the same way as I wouldn't want to go in for kidney surgery with a doctor who said, oh, I read a bunch of books.
Yeah, I would draw a distinction, though, between medicine. I think there is a distinction between medicine and the law in this regard. So you use the phrase gatekeeper, and what the ABA does, the American Bar Association, it seems to me, is act as a gatekeeper. I don't think the stakes are as high if your lawyer is self-taught as if your doctor is self-taught.
Oh, I disagree. If I'm going and there's a trial and...
Yeah, but you're enthralled to lawyers. You admitted this at the outset. You need to step outside and see the world as it is, David.
Yeah, so Frank, when you're on trial for, you know, bank robbery or murder or whatever...
Well, Michael Avenatti is going to defend
me. Who went to law school.
I want a lawyer who went to law school, but I'm not so sure that every lawyer has to go to law school.
I think... You know, one of the things we hope for is that, you know, people who are put on trial where they are at risk of losing their liberty or their life, they have a competent defense. And that, you know, they are constitutionally entitled to counsel. And if the counsel is... You know, not competent. I think that jeopardizes the integrity of the whole system.
Sure, but there are incompetent lawyers who've gone through this system successfully.
Oh, to be sure. Just as there are incompetent physicians.
Well, I think about our own profession. I mean, we've created standards and there are gatekeepers and everything. And we need certain credentials to get where we are, and we've earned those, and our colleagues have earned them and everything else, and that's perfectly legitimate. On the other hand, you know, to some extent, you could become a world-class historian.
Yes.
Without having a PhD.
To be sure.
By either almost apprenticing yourself to existing historians, and or through reading and self-training.
Yeah.
So I don't know why...
But the consequences if I screw up are none, because all the people I work with are dead. You know, if I'm a lawyer and because I screw up...
You work with me.
Oh, yes, but the consequences of me doing bad historical practice, you know, are pretty minimal. Like, no one's going to get sent to jail because I didn't, you know, footnote something correctly. So I think it's a different, you know, because the consequences are so much larger, you know, the kind of professionalization that happens with lawyers, and the need to have them be certified and have continuing education and keep up to date.
This is not what we intended to discuss, but I want to pursue this a little bit.
Okay.
I want to take a kind of libertarian, almost free market position on this.
Yes.
So if young Abraham Lincoln of the 21st century comes along, and she has taught herself the law, and we're talking about a person of particular intellectual genius and really gifts, and she manages to pass the bar exam. So I'm not saying they're unqualified. The bar exam is meant to be that qualification, and is able to demonstrate that she has the ability and the knowledge of the law to pass the bar exam and then to practice. Now, once you're practicing law, you would still need to meet all of those qualifications about professional development and keeping up and everything else. And I don't know why she could not do that and you let the market decide, you let punters off the street decide whether they want to go to her as a lawyer, even though she didn't go to law school. In other words, I'm not so sure that you're saying the stakes are high. Sure they are, but they're not that high. It seems to me that...
Sure they're high. I mean, frankly, you have people on trial for...
The bar exam is the gate. The bar exam is the gate, not the law degree before it.
Well, you can't take the bar exam unless you have a law degree.
No, but that's because the club has decided that.
Well, yes, true.
See, my view is why couldn't somebody just, you know, as I said, download the syllabus from Harvard Law School, follow it, teach themselves, and if they pass the bar exam, well, God bless them.
Yeah, Frank, you know you've got friends who teach at law schools who are going to be mad at you as a consequence of this.
I'm becoming increasingly... I began with kind of devil's advocacy here, but yeah. Now I'm thinking... And again, when I'm on trial, I want a lawyer.
You want the law school.
I want the law school one, but that would be my choice.
Okay.
I think you're just a tool of the man, David, and you're standing for the system, whereas I am I'm standing for democracy.
Oh, okay.
Democratizing knowledge.
Well, I don't want to have a fight at the next family reunion, so I think that's a good thing.
Okay, that's a perfectly reasonable reason.
Okay.
That's a position. Reasonable position, rather.
Yeah, one of my father-in-law used to be a dean of a law school, and he seemed to think it was a meaningful thing. Thinking about, though, the role of lawyers in politics, I think the other sort of pivotal point happens in the 19-teens and 1920s when you've got the formation of the NAACP, the Anti-Defamation League, and then especially the ACLU in 1920.
The American Civil Liberties Union,
yes.
For our listeners.
Oh, yes, sorry. And what all these organizations have in common, and they often work together over the coming century, is you've got lawyers working, you know, not necessarily for profit, not necessarily for, personal self-betterment or for the interests of a well-heeled client, but for the interests of, you know, maintaining certain kinds of civil liberties, certain kinds of protections of the law to help in some ways the weak against the powerful interests of the strong. And so if you think about, you know, political developments in the 20th century, one way to make sense of how the United States changes, you know, in terms of the legal rights of individuals, whether that's sort of Miranda rights, whether that's rights to access to a lawyer, like in the Gideon case, whether it's Brown versus Board of Education, you know, whether it's abortion rights, a lot of those rights that Americans value very quite deeply, I think, arise from sort of these professional organizations of lawyers that are working and engaging in politics, if you will, but going through the courts instead of going through the legislature. And so, you know, one way to think about how, you know, the laws influence politics, you know, many of the big political issues of the day are not decided in legislative halls, but they're actually decided in courtrooms.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I think that's something that emerged in the first half of the 20th century. Mm. And it's a lesson... And I know we're going to get to this. Mm. The conservatives seem to have learned more than liberals, or better than liberals. So although the organizations you just named, the Anti-Defamation League, the NAACP, and the ACLU in particular, have tended to be on the left side of the political spectrum, although the ACLU's got a kind of very interesting and complicated history on a lot of these issues. I think the lesson conservatives learned from what they saw as a kind of leftward tilt to the courts in the first half of the 20th century was to pay attention to the judiciary. Mm. And I think what we've seen in the second half of the 20th century and then now the 21st century is conservatives in the United States paying much more attention to the importance of the courts, including the lower courts, but also the Supreme Court, in and seeing those in political terms and understanding the correlation between politics and the law in a way that I think that I don't think liberals have always appreciated.
Yeah.
Would you agree with that?
Well, I mean, I think there's, you know, if you're looking at a particular moment in time when conservatives really start to think about the law in that way, you know, I think I'd have to point to, you know, the creation of the Federalist Society in 1982. Because there had been this tremendous growth in people using the courts throughout the 50s and 60s and 70s under the Warren Court, under the Burger Court, to expand civil liberties, often in progressive leftist kind of ways. You know, the law became seen in some ways as defenders of left-leaning political views. You know, the people who founded the Federalist Society, it starts off as an organization on law school campuses, but then blooms into something much, much larger. You know, I think the idea behind the Federalist Society was they saw the legal profession as a whole as being on the left. They saw the American Bar Association as being left-leaning. How true that critique is, I'm not sure. And they saw law schools as being also left-leaning. And I think in the era of, you know, the Reagan Revolution, conservative lawyers said we need an alternative to the American Bar Association, an alternative set of voices for creating a conservative jurisprudence in the legal profession. And, you know, you have, I think early on, people like Attorney General Edwin Meese, Solicitor General Robert Bork, who obviously is later named by Ronald Reagan to the Supreme Court, but then has a pretty disastrous confirmation hearing and doesn't get confirmed. But also people like Antonin Scalia and Clarence Thomas, who are, you know, very involved in crafting a kind of conservative jurisprudence within the Federalist Society that leans towards strict constructionalism, textual readings of both the Constitution and the law more broadly. And they've become very influential in Republican circles, especially under the Trump administration, in terms of shaping both legal policy and shaping appointments. One of the things I remember from Trump's campaign is that he came up with a list of people he said he would appoint to federal judgeships. And that list came not from within the Trump campaign. That list came from the Federalist Society. And if you look at, you know, the kind of criteria the Federalist Society is using, it's very much interested in finding judges who have particular political or social views to appoint to judge, you know, appoint to the bench that will push a particular political agenda. And I think you see that with the sort of Brett Kavanaugh appointment, or at least nomination, to the Supreme Court, and we're going to hear of the confirmation hearings in a few months about for that. So I think that's a very interesting moment in which the law is becoming much more politicized, because very much now you have, you know, the Federalist Society, which is the conservative organization, and the American Bar Association, which is perceived as being the more liberal progressive sort of flip side of that. You saw some of that, in fact, very recently last week when the American Bar Association had their annual meeting. It became very much seen as a commentary on the Trump administration, the Trump administration's, through Jeff Sessions, their legal stance on immigration, on gun control, on rights of the accused and what have you. So the law, I think, has become very politicized in recent decades in a way that it, I guess it's always been very political as an institution, but it's become more so.
Yeah, David, I mean, I agree with your analysis. I think it's spot on, except for your use of the verb become. I would say, you know, 'twas ever thus. Jefferson, when he was president, when John Adams was on his way out the door, having lost the election of 1800, what did he do? He packed the judiciary with lifetime appointees. Jefferson sought to unpick that. He went to war, more or less, with John Marshall, who was the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Their interaction was incredibly political. I'm sure from your period, and you're more expert than me, but in the middle period of American history, that would also be so. I think even in the early 20th century, one of the things the conservatives railed against, and the reason the Federalist Society was created, if you will, is because they believed that the courts had been leftward leaning. And so I think we think the courts are fair and balanced when they agree with us, and they're political when we don't. I think you're right. I think it's heavily political. And I think that one of the most egregious stories in American politics in recent years, and one that will linger for a long, long time to come, is the is Mitch McConnell's blocking of the appointment of Merrick Garland and the consequent appointment of Neil Gorsuch at the Supreme Court, who of course was Federalist Society approved.
Yes.
And that was seemed to be a bald face theft of a Supreme Court seat by the conservatives.
Mm.
But that's politics. When back in the 30s, when FDR tried to pack the court to expand the numbers in the Supreme Court, that was political. So I think the premise of our discussion today, our point of departure a few minutes ago, was that the law and politics have always been closely intertwined in the United States. So I'm not sure this moment is necessarily more or less political than in the past.
Well, I mean, I think the appointment of judges is always political because it's done by politicians. I think the thing that's different about this particular moment we're in is how explicitly political it is, rather than, there's usually the pretense, and you saw this for most of the 20th century, that you appoint the judge based on their qualification, their expertise as a legal thinker, independent of their stance on particular issues. And in some ways, that's how you end up with sometimes Republicans appointing people who end up being liberal justices, and Democrats end up appointing people who end up being conservatives. Yeah, so you see all that happening occasionally in the 20th century. Whereas I think very much now, the Trump administration and the Federal Society are creating, very specific litmus tests for who they want as a judge. Will you overturn Roe versus Wade? Will you uphold certain conceptions of the powers of the executive office, and what have you? That makes it more explicitly political.
I think they're doing that, but I think they're reaping the benefits of having paid attention to this for 40 years, going back to the foundation of the Federalist Society, and paying attention to off-year elections, and paying attention to Senate races and so on, and Democrats have not paid the same attention to the kind of lower levels of politics and the lower levels of the courts, and they're going to need to, because the Supreme Court, it would appear, for the foreseeable future, is going to be a much, much more conservative institution than it has from most of the recent past. But that's a consequence of politics, and apart from the theft of the Garland seat, most of this has been just down to winning elections. And the answer for folks on the left, if they want to appoint Supreme Court justices, is to win the presidency and win the Senate.
Yeah. Well, we're going to see what's going to happen in the midterms, but that's a topic for a different show.
I'm sure we'll be talking about that.
Yeah. All right, Frank, what's your last drop?
I have two, David. I want to say hello to two listeners who recently got in touch in the past few days and thank them. As you know, we always like it when listeners get in touch. So Lori from Fresno and, closer to home, Emma from Sterling got in touch. just to say they liked recent episodes and they liked the podcast. So thank you for listening, and thanks for making the effort to say hello. My last drop, though, is that the second series of Slow Burn is now out. Slow Burn was something I recommended once in the past. It's a podcast from Slate. The first series, which if you haven't listened to, you should, presented the history of Watergate. The second series is looking at the impeachment of Bill Clinton, which, of course, I remember, you remember, was more than 20 years ago now. And so a lot of time has passed, and they've interviewed a lot of people. Slow Burn is an excellent podcast, very, very high quality research and very well presented. And it's great stuff. So listen to the second series. It's not like binge watching on Netflix. You can listen to the second series without having heard the first one. But listen to both of them, I would say. What's yours, David?
Well, I also want to endorse a podcast. As of this morning, it actually isn't up on Apple iTunes yet. I think it will be in the next 24 to 48 hours. It's a podcast called A12. So this weekend is the one-year anniversary of the events in Charlottesville. And this is a podcast about sort of both the backstory to what happened a year ago in Charlottesville and the consequences in the years since on the Charlottesville community. And it's put together by a historian at UVA, Nicole Hemmer, who teaches there and is associated with the Miller Center at UVA. And I heard a preview of it. They had a preview of part of an episode on the most recent feed for Backstory. Our friends at Backstory shared a part of an episode. And it was really extraordinary, and I'm looking forward to hearing the rest of the series.
Excellent.
All right. Until next week, Frank.
Yep. Cheers, David.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod, and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.